A baseball game, a day in a park with friends and family, fishing in a remote stream, work, travels, providing for loved ones, or heading out for adventures. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. The original Guide to Men's Health is presented by the Washington State Urology Society to help take you through the steps necessary to get the most out of life. If you have invested in a retirement plan for your future, why not invest in your body? After all, it makes better sense to retire healthy and enjoy your future. These podcasts are a guide for how to take care of yourself. If you take care of your car and maintain it, why not do the same for your personal machine, your body? If you know you should but haven't yet, the information in these podcasts contains some easy recommendations for where, when, and how to get started. Follow the podcast as we explore men's health with renowned experts and embark on a journey towards better health. On this episode of the original Guide to Men's Health, we'll be reviewing The Aging Male with Dr. Vittoria Gassman. Dr. Gassman is the medical director of Jewish Senior Services Institute on Aging. She is a clinical assistant professor at the Quinnipiac School of Medicine, Hamden, Connecticut. Dr. Gassman received her medical doctorate at New York University and completed her residency also at NYU. She is also certified in geriatric medicine. Welcome, Dr. Gassman.
Thank you for inviting me to be with you.
It's great to have a discussion about something that is relevant as we move through life, meaning as we age. And I think I'd like to start with just a review of what is a geriatrician? What is different about seeing a geriatric specialist than your primary care physician?
Geriatrics is a fairly new specialty. Gerontology refers to non-physician specialists who study the aging process and older people in society. But geriatrics is the medical specialty that focuses on people as they get older.
So when we look at an aging population and they have a primary care physician, when would they transition or should they transition to a geriatric specialist?
It would be ideal if they could transition, if everyone could transition at a certain point, but there aren't enough geriatricians in the country. So we try to educate primary care physicians and other specialists and teach them a little bit about geriatrics so that they can continue to help their patients. We mostly work as consultants in the hospital or in the outpatient setting. And if there's a concern, for example, about dementia, we often get consultations and a referral for a patient for that. And we try to look at the whole individual, the medications, talk to them about their psychosocial well-being, physical exam, which includes walking and how they get around, etc. It's time consuming, but if there are concerns that somebody is not doing well as they're aging, it can be a very helpful thing to do.
So what age would you generally say the population that would be seen by a geriatric specialist, by a geriatrician, would it be somebody in their 60s to 70s, 70 to 80s, or 80s to, you know, is it just really how is that individual doing? I mean, what age group do you start to recommend people moving over?
It's gotten older and older. I think most of the patients I see as outpatients in my office are well into their 80s. If somebody's getting frail and there's a concern about dementia in the 70s, then that person could definitely seek consultation. And in the nursing home where I work, the average age is 90, the mean age. So half the patients are over 90, half are under.
Interesting. The aging process is somewhat subtle. Sometimes people sometimes have things that make it more dramatic. But what would you recommend to the population that begins aging, say later 60s to 70s, that they should start being aware of? And if they're not seeing a geriatrician, at least to make certain that they bring up to their primary.
Functional abilities are really important. We study what are called the activities of daily living. So if a person is having trouble walking, if they're having falls, if there are hygiene problems, people aren't bathing, those kind of things definitely could seek some geriatric specialist help. But I think in general, there's still a lot of things we don't know, but exercise and physical function are really important. We try to emphasize that with patients because many of the geriatric syndromes, such as falls, seem to be consequences of diminishing strength or balance and problems with the activities of daily living.
So people should not get sedentary, to try to keep moving, keep exercising at some form, maintaining right. some musculoskeletal fitness, some muscle density, range of motion.
Yes.
And that starts early and you just have to continue it.
I'm a big fan of Tai Chi as well as other types of exercise. I have attended Tai Chi classes myself, and I'm currently looking for a class, but it's a very interesting way to work on your balance. And it's the only exercise that has been proven over and over to decrease the risk of falls, even better than working with a physical therapist. So that can be an interesting thing to do for people.
And that helps with the balance and, you know, transition from people playing sports to some seniors continue, but say a senior who golfs or plays tennis, but then loses some of the ability to do that as well. You would want them to move to something where they continue to be active and work on balance and movement skills. And you're saying Tai Chi is nice.
And walking is good. Many people give up walking, but it's a great form of exercise. Doesn't have to be fast, but walking every day definitely maintains some form of physical functioning and muscle strength. Yeah.
Do you have people walk with hand weights or anything to maintain upper body strength when they do that? Or is that a separate, would you recommend a separate exercise set?
We usually recommend second set of exercises for that. But if people are quite fit and they want to use hand weights, that's perfect.
This would be a daily outing?
Yes, the government has recommended, you know, all different things from 3 times a week to 5 days a week, but maybe a majority of the days in the week, people should be out there doing something.
If we then move from exercise to just being aware of things that are subtle, that change eyesight, hearing, that becomes an issue, particularly hearing loss for seniors.
Yes, that's very important. Hearing loss is widespread in the aging population, and we expect there's going to be more of it because the baby boomer generation did have the delight and unfortunate consequences of listening to too much rock music and blasted their hearing functions. So, and I know many older people resist getting hearing aids. They resist getting tested. It's a stigma that's been around for a long time, probably starting when the hearing aids were very bulky and not nice to look at. But hearing aids now are tiny. They can't even be seen. And hearing loss is associated with developing dementia. Nobody wants to have dementia or any cognitive loss, and hearing loss is definitely involved in that process. So that can help motivate people to go get a hearing test and then hearing aids if they need them. The other problem with hearing devices is they're very expensive and Medicare doesn't typically provide them. Some of the Medicare managed plans, the Advantage Medicare plans, will cover it, and that's a great thing because they can cost many thousands of dollars.
The acuity of hearing does fall off over time. So you would start with getting a hearing test, which is fairly easy to do and arrange, but it's just making somebody aware that they need to be checked.
The primary care physician should be doing what's called a whisper test. They stand a few feet away from the patient and they cover their mouth and whisper numbers, or somebody could do that with their spouse and check each ear separately. But if you can't hear whispered numbers from 2 or 3 feet away, there may be a problem.
If somebody acquires a hearing aid, is that good for life, or do you need to upgrade continuously as hearing changes or worsens?
They may be able to make adjustments as hearing worsens, but they don't typically need many new hearing aids. Of course, they're very small. They do get lost. But apart from that, you may not need multiple sets of them as hearing worsens as people age.
And then you mentioned, you know, mental status changes. And of course, we talk about people aging and just having normal loss of some memory. What distinguishes somebody who's truly getting dementia, and then in dementia is the spectrum of Alzheimer's versus other forms of dementia? Go into a little bit about that, because that compromises a significant portion of people's health is if they do develop that.
We know that dementia increases with age. More than 50% of people in their 90s do have some degree of dementia. And we're still not completely sure what can prevent it. There's some hope that a healthy diet and more physical exercise may prevent it, but there's nothing very obvious in terms of medication or vitamins. Nothing's been shown to really work in terms of medication. Many people start having problems with memory, especially with remembering names and associating faces to names. That's not thought to be all that significant. It's quite universal, but missing a few names here and there is not really a warning sign. But when somebody starts to have problems in multiple areas of their life, for example, at home, in terms of their family relationships, and or at work, completing their work tasks, that already is a big red flag, and that person certainly needs a dementia evaluation. Most of dementia in this country is Alzheimer's disease. It hasn't been clear to the public, and I hear this question all the time, what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? I'm not sure which word is scarier, but they're both pretty scary. But in the United States, approximately 75% of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And the rest are comprised of things like vascular dementia, which means an accumulation of small strokes or TIAs that seem to rob the patient of their memory and other faculties, and some more rare variants, such as Lewy body dementia, which is very associated with Parkinson's disease, and some others. But the vast majority is Alzheimer's, and it's very gradual and insidious. And I find that most people, and especially the families, don't recognize it as it gets worse and worse. I did a lot of primary care myself over the years, and I can honestly say that I missed it many, many times in my practice. And I think the issue for families and primary care doctors is that when you have a lot of contact with the person, it's hard to see the changes. You know, it may feel that it's just the patient's personality, or they're just getting more stubborn, or they've always been like that and now it's more so. But this disease, you know, it takes over the brain very slowly, and sometimes an outside consultant can see it. A geriatrician or a neurologist can more quickly put their finger on it. Unfortunately, we've spent a lot of time in this country researching dementia, and we haven't gotten very far, unfortunately. We do have some medications, but they're not very helpful. They seem to stabilize the patient at the level they're at. But I think scientists have been working on a hypothesis about the cause of Alzheimer's disease, which is called the amyloid hypothesis. There's this substance in the brain called amyloid, and all the treatments in terms of medication have been focused on this. And in the last year or so, there's been a lot of rethinking, and it seems now that the amyloid is not the cause of dementia, but is something that happens along with it or as a byproduct of the disease. Luckily, there is a lot of research going on. I really recommend the Alzheimer's Association website, which has a lot of helpful information, very accessible to families and patients, etc. And there's a lot to learn about this. It's fascinating, and unfortunately, it's still
for
not a
just
good
dementia in general and trying to be healthy. We know that good sleep has a significant impact on the development of dementia. So, you know, sleep specialist making certain that you don't have sleep apnea seems to be at least one of the issues involved in onset of dementia.
Yes, I agree with that. There's even some very interesting research about that, that I think it's mostly been done in animals, but there are some small studies in humans showing that there may be a whole new organ in our brains that is responsible for draining out of the brain toxic byproducts of metabolism, including the amyloid, etc., that seems to function best when somebody is in the deep sleep stage. REM is an important sleep stage, but it's light sleep, and that's when you have dreams. But everybody cycles through various stages of sleep 3 or 4 or 5 times every night, and deep sleep may turn out to be a key time when our brains get rid of toxins, and that's just very fascinating to me. You know, I mainly work in a nursing home, and very few people in the nursing home get a good night's sleep. We try to work on things like decreasing the sound, having the lights low, trying to get people good sunlight exposure in the daytime. That helps with sleep. But most of them have very fragmented sleep patterns. I know you're a urologist, so you know, bladder spasms and having to urinate every 2 hours all night long is very disruptive to sleep.
Yes, it's one of the major issues we see. I always try to make certain that the issues with nighttime urination or nocturia is something that is looked into, as there are many other reasons besides just bladder prostate issues. People who have sleep apnea, for instance, will get up thinking they need to urinate, and it's really they're awake because of air hunger. Sometimes they have mobilization of fluid just due to physiological issues, and you know, some of it's reversible. So it's a great point you make, and it is something that robs people of valuable sleep time and should be looked into. But it isn't always bladder prostate. For looking at the population that needs to control cholesterol, blood pressure, that certainly prevents some of that microvascular disease you were talking about that can lead to dementia. So just good health and taking care of those issues as well can help.
Yes, blood pressure control, cholesterol, diabetes, all the traditional cardiovascular risk factors are probably implicated in the development of Alzheimer's. So making sure your blood pressure is at a good level, keeping your cholesterol well controlled, and really working on the diabetes can help postpone or prevent dementia too.
If we look at the opportunity to look at a different spectrum of the mental issues, meaning depression, certainly as people age and lose function, perhaps can't work anymore, maybe lose a spouse, you see a spectrum of issues.
That is very important. Depression is really widespread in this society, and I think you're right. You talked about losing the spouse and losing the job or the functional role in society. That's very important. I think especially men who retire, I think, do have a hard time adjusting to that retirement if they haven't made some preparations ahead of time. You know, thinking ahead of time what you're going to do with all that free time can be really helpful. And we do see some men who really get into their hobbies, develop new hobbies, take up bridge or other games, and all that is very healthy. Men are much less likely than women to lose their spouse because men still have a shorter life expectancy at every age. So women are much more likely to live without a partner for many years, and we see that in the nursing home. Most men, even over 85, about a third of them are still married, which is much better than for women. Three quarters of them are widowed over 85. So that partnership, that companionship is so important. You know, there's not too much you can do at the end of life about that, but having some other social contacts is really important. People who do volunteering or some participation in the community, that they really get a benefit from that. It's not just they're helping others, it's good for them. And it can even be phone volunteering, you know, having a phone pal who you call once a week. That can be a great activity, even if somebody's at home. But, you know, in the real world, all of that is really important. At my nursing home, we're lucky. We have what's called the work center. It's a, most nursing homes don't have this, although they could try and create a similar thing, and some definitely do. But it's basically clerical work, and many residents of the nursing home will come and work there morning and afternoon, 5 days a week, except for holidays. And it's a social activity, so that's nice. People talk and make jokes with each other, and it's friendly. But I think underneath that is this hidden sense of having a purpose. It's very important to people. And, you know, if a man has been deeply engaged in his career or his job, that finding some way to recreate that in retirement and in old age, I think is just critical. I have patients who get an infection and I ask them to stay in their rooms for a few days and take medication. And the first question they ask me, they say, but doctor, can I go to work tomorrow? And, you know, even if they have a fever and they want to get back to their usual routine. And that's a very important human trait. We want to feel like we have a purpose.
And that's something that if somebody's listening and they have a parent who maybe is becoming more socially isolated, that's as difficult as somebody who becomes sedentary. So they need to make sure they become engaged in some sort of activity, some sort of social event. You've brought up the nursing home. So let's move a little bit into, as people age, when they want to transition from independent living or maybe independent living into a different living situation, when does that occur? How do you advise patients regarding that? Do they say, well, we've been living in our own house, we're thinking of going into an assisted living situation or an independent condo with assisted living, possibly nursing home attached to it? What do you advise people?
Unfortunately, you know, our health system in this country is very fragmented. And it's really up to individuals and their families to find what the resources are near them. Assisted living was meant to be for pretty independent, healthy seniors, but they have become much more for people who are frailer, not quite as independent, and needing more help. Nursing home criteria are pretty definite. The criterion to get into a nursing home is if you need help with three or more basic activities of daily living. So that's walking, bathing, toileting, dressing, those kind of things. And if you need help with three or more of those, you probably can be in a nursing home. And along with those functional problems, obviously comes the medical issues that create those problems with function. So a patient might have heart failure, diabetes, they may have a few falls and a hip fracture because of that. But to get into a nursing home, in general, the criteria are functional problems in three or more basic activities of daily living.
And then we are doing this recording in the time of COVID-19, and obviously people are worried about transmission of whether it's this virus or something that comes along, or even flu during normal flu season through nursing homes. So that's something that you're a medical director of a nursing home, and you have a nursing home population. You want a nursing home that is well supervised and has plans for taking care of issues like this.
Right. It's been terrifying. In the state of Connecticut, I don't think we're doing too badly, but we are scrambling to keep the vulnerable older people safe. One thing is there is a new model for nursing homes called the small house model. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
So it's been around for a while, and I believe on the West Coast and somewhat in the Midwest, they are building new nursing homes on this model. And our nursing home in Connecticut is built on the small house model, and it's been great for decreasing the transmission of infections. We've been in the building 3 years and we've seen it with flu, and hopefully we're going to see it with the COVID-19. Basically, there is no giant dining area for everybody to go to, and there are no long halls with the nursing station in the middle, and it looks like a hospital. Rather, it's the whole home is built, broken up into 14 person units. They call them houses. And there's a door and a doorbell for each one. And then there's 14 people with private rooms and baths and some common areas, a kitchen, which looks like a nice suburban kitchen, and a dining room, dining area, a living room, and a porch for fresh air. It's been very helpful for isolating people who are sick in their rooms and decreasing the risk of the infection going all over the building. So I'm grateful that we have that. And your listeners, if they're looking for a nursing home or even an assisted living, the new ones seem to be built on this model.
It looks like it's a more successful model, and hopefully newer homes will be following that pattern.
Yes, we hope so.
So any resources that you would refer people to that they could find online that you would tell them that they, if they want more information as far as aging?
Number one is the Alzheimer's Association. They can Google it. There are different chapters in every state and different regional associations. And there is a lot of really good information there about aging and dementia. And the other resource I'll mention is the American Geriatric Society. They have information for the public and for patients, also all different topics about healthy aging and about diseases as well. And I think those are very good sources. There are so many, social media and the internet is just wonderful, but there is so much potential with that, but there is a lot of misinformation and not good sources that you can't trust. And I hope the public will, you know, keep challenging and checking out the sources that they're using and making sure that they're reliable and consistent.
Just summing up, staying healthy as we age, it sounds like we should continue to be active and not be sedentary, and active not only physically, but mentally and socially engaged.
Yes, I think you've got it. That's absolutely right.
Well, I really appreciate your spending time, and it's been wonderful. Aging is this spectrum that we all face, and so it's great to have a resource, and hopefully there'll be more geriatricians in the future.
Yes, that would be great, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, we appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Gassman.
You're welcome.
This completes another podcast chapter of the Washington State Urology Society's original Guide to Men's Health. This is Dr. Richard Pellman reminding you to take care of yourself. The Washington State Urology Society wishes to thank all contributors who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The Society also wishes to thank Sean Fox for his invaluable technical assistance. Music theme, San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. Dave Weidig. The podcasts are the property of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the express consent of the Society is strictly prohibited. For more information about men's health, visit wsus.org or visit your physician or care provider.